Alrighty, welcome back to the Relay Bitcoin podcast. I'm sitting here with the legend Joe Hall, aka Joe Nakamoto, joining me from his balcony with a green screen. Why the hell do you sit in front of a green screen?
Bit of a long story, because I also didn't say in the preamble to this that I've just rented like an office space, and I'm trying to convert that into like a proper like creation studio slash a space where I can go where my girlfriend doesn't get annoyed at me for talking about Bitcoin all day. But in the process, I didn't have electricity for a while over there because Portuguese infrastructure is a nightmare to deal with. And so right now I'm filming a video about the Bitcoin emoji, hopefully entering our libraries very soon. And so I put a green screen on my balcony and I'm trying to play around with that and trying to work out how to make it make sense and how to make it engaging. I don't have my usual setup either. Like I do have a microphone, so it should sound okay. So sorry, listeners, if I sound awful. It does. Fantastic. But yeah, the green screen is for your editing team to do whatever they want with. You can put me in a McDonald's serving burgers. You can put me on the moon. I mean, you can put me in the Relay offices if you want, as of course, I am an advisor to Relay. And I'm going to be very, you know, upfront about that, just in case people are wondering why I'm super nice.
At this point of recording, I don't know whether we are able to do this or not, but it's going to be fun for either the listeners or the viewers on YouTube. They see all this, which you just mentioned, McDonald's, Relay office, etc. See you in front of a green screen.
Yeah, maybe your video editor just rugs me and it's like, whatever, you can just be green, mate.
in any case, it's going to be fun. Cool. But you're literally on a balcony right now in Portugal.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, Portugal. I moved here like 5 years ago. Well, I did a project here in 2018 and I was living here for 6 months. And at the time I was like in my early mid-20s and I was trying to work out where is the best place to live in Europe, like for quality of life. And I was like, I think Lisbon could be the one. But now I've moved outside of Lisbon to a small sort of fishing slash surfing village where it's like a bit cheaper than Lisbon. It's less pretentious than Lisbon. No offense to anyone that lives in Lisbon, but you'll know what I'm talking about, as there are lots of digital nomad and wantrepreneur types, which I guess I am now as well, which is kind of ironic. You know, those guys that arrive and they're like, oh yeah, I'm going to like decentralize recycling, or I'm going to, you know, put shoes on the blockchain. There's a lot of those kind of types.
Crypto shit around Lisbon, right?
So much. Yeah, it's a real haven for it. I guess because there's 0% tax on crypto if you don't, if you hodl, which is similar to Germany and maybe Switzerland. I can't remember what your tax regime is.
Switzerland is really like free, whatever you do, whether you trade or whether you hold, doesn't really matter. But Germany is like, if you hold it for a year, if you hold Bitcoin for a year, it's like tax free, I think.
Yeah, I'm the same. So I try to label UTXOs, but I'm also aware that the tax department is probably like, who cares? Like part of the, yeah, exactly. Like part of the reason I think there is 0% tax is just they haven't dealt with it. They haven't treated it seriously. And now they're going to have to deal with it and treat it seriously because of the global sort of outlook on Bitcoin and crypto.
Of course. Yeah, I love that. You're right. I mean, Portugal seems to be the best, the best place to live in Europe. It's a great compromise. And especially also, well, then we're just in Madeira, right?
Yeah.
Madeira is like the perfect place to live.
It's amazing, right?
It's not. It's maybe not really Portugal. It is Portugal, but politically, but geographically, it's obviously more Africa. It's like on the same altitude as Morocco. Also from the climate, etc. But it's very green, not like the Canary Islands that are more like deserts, but also in the same range. But it's very cheap there, but the quality of living is very high. And it's very green and it's beautiful and the people are nice and everything seems so affordable, but still so high quality. The weather is obviously amazing, like whatever, 300 plus sunny days. And it's always like this internal spring, etc. It is an amazing place to live. How did you perceive the conference and Madeira in general?
I mean, the conference was amazing. It was so impressive to see how Andre Loja and his team and the Free Madeira guys pulled this thing off. Because, you know, 6 months ago, maybe 9 months ago, it was like, what on earth is Jack Dorsey and Michael Saylor? What are they doing going to this tiny island in the middle of the Atlantic near Africa? But let's be honest, most people at that conference had never heard of Madeira before like going there, which is also like, I found that with my own Bitcoin experience. I'll be flying to places that I didn't know they existed. Like, I made a documentary about a place called Plovdiv. I didn't know what a Plovdiv was until, you know, they adopted Bitcoin. Same thing with Bedford. Like, I would never want to go to Bedford. No offense to Bedford, but it's true. But now there's this Bitcoin thing. You're like, yeah, I'll go there. But the added benefit of Madeira is, as you describe, it is a paradise in the middle of the Atlantic that's got insane EU-sponsored infrastructure. You know, there's like tunnels through mountains and highways over other highways. And there's even like cable cars down to just, you know, 200 people, which, you know, that might make sense in Switzerland, where, of course, everyone's making a load of money. But in Portugal, the average or the minimum wage is like between 700 and 1,000 euros a month. So like really not a lot of money. But that's also one thing I really love about Portuguese culture generally, is that people are quite happy with earning, or that maybe this is horrible to generalize, but you can earn very little in Portugal, and I am proof of that, and have a really good quality of life, because you can always spend your weekends on holiday, and I'm doing quotation marks there, because within 20 minutes of pretty much anywhere in Portugal, you're at a beach or a mountain or like incredible lush countryside. Whereas if you're in London, you know, you would an hour before you get to like a big, you know, big place, or you go 20 minutes like a Richmond Park or a, I don't know, Green Park or St. James's Park. But you also have to earn, you know, four or five times what you earn here just to be able to live like really comfortably and to have, you know, to put a smile on your face. So I think it's got this winning formula.
Yeah. Exactly. It's this perfect compromise between high living standards comparable to like Switzerland, but not the prices of Switzerland. It's like 10x lower in Switzerland.
Oh, yeah.
And in Switzerland, easily in Zurich, you would pay between $4 or $5 for an espresso, like super small coffee.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
But there it's like 90 cents to maybe 110, depending on where it is, but easily you get it for 90 cents. And probably if you get out of Funchal, like this, like half an hour out of the city, you probably get it for like 60, 70 cents, I heard.
Yeah, it's 60 cents where I live. Unless you go to like the bougie nomad places. The nomad places are now charging like €2 an espresso, but it's because they can. Like if you go to the actual local Portuguese places where they don't speak much English, and like, a lot of my locals, they joke with me, and obviously I stick out because I'm quite tall. I'm not very Portuguesey looking, like compared to like a Portuguese person, and so, you know, they know that I'm the English, and they treat me as such, and it's good fun. Like I have a good rapport with the people that I know here on a local basis. Unfortunately, very few of them are open to the Bitcoin idea, and I've been trying my best to onboard merchants during the bear market, and now that it's like it feels like obviously we're in a bull market, right? I'm less keen on onboarding merchants, knowing that the corrections will really like scare them.
To tell you about Relay Private. It's our exclusive service for private clients, small offices, small to mid-sized businesses, or just anyone looking to stack more sats with a higher volume. As a Relay Private client, you'll have access to a dedicated account manager, a team, and obviously a white glove service to help you with your Bitcoin needs. You also get personalized 24/7 access to our team, and you are in it for the special selection of reports and data we are sending to our Relay Private clients. If that sounds like something you or someone you know should like, send them to relay.app/private or click the link in the description below.
You know, like if you onboard someone at 20K, I'm like happy now. I'm like, you guys are going to get it because whatever I paid for at your coffee shop or your burrito restaurant, all of it is 3x'd. Or more in fiat terms. Yeah. Whereas now I'm like, okay, yeah, it could 4 or 5x from here. You know, we could have 200K or 300K Bitcoin, but there's going to be some horrific corrections along the way. And I don't want that responsibility or that onus on me to be the guy that has to explain to them, don't worry, it's normal. You know, it's going to go up again in 4 or 5 years' time. It's just so much easier to onboard in the bear.
Yeah, totally. I get that. But don't you also think it's easier maybe now that we are in a bull market and like because the price shoots up, it's in the like Bitcoin is in the media everywhere and everyone's talking about it and it's like it's in again, it's en vogue. Don't you think that now maybe is a good time? For example, in my experience, just this morning actually, coincidence. I'm not as a frequent orange piller as you are or active orange piller as you are.
Well, it's because your company does it, mate.
In terms of merchant acquisition, basically, I don't talk to a lot of merchants. Like, I also never ask, "Do you accept Bitcoin, etc." It's just not my thing. Yours is. It's great. But this morning, somehow we talked about Bitcoin with my barber, and then at the end, I asked him, so because he was really keen, he was very interested. And I think he owned some Bitcoin, also some other shitcoins. And then I was asking, would you be keen to accept Bitcoin for your business? He was like, yeah, it would be great, but it's much too complicated. So I just asked him to download the Relay app and showed him how he can receive. Basically, it's just a QR code. It works like Twint. Yeah. Twint is like Cash App here in Switzerland. So it's super easy to send money via QR code. And you can basically just show this to your people and then you to your customers and they can send you Bitcoin. You can hold it or you can sell it if you want. And you can even print this QR code out and stick it there and people can just buy Bitcoin. And he's like, wow, that's super cool. It was super easy. I have a lot of clients that probably will use this because they tell me they have Bitcoin, etc. And because now with a lot of clients, he is talking about Bitcoin because Bitcoin just hit a new all-time high, etc.
Classic barbers.
Yeah, but exactly. But he was very open to it. So I think now might be the time. But I agree with you that maybe in half a year when we have a crazy correction of 40-50%, maybe they won't be unhappy. But yeah, I don't know.
No, I agree with the sentiment. It's easier to onboard now, but it's more about the fact that I don't want that responsibility of dealing with the tears when it does crash and when they put their life savings into it because they're like, well, this thing just goes up forever, doesn't it? Because in a bull run, you do get that euphoria and you're like, well, I don't have enough Bitcoin. This thing's going to be at 200K by tomorrow. I need to put everything in. And I would rather do it during the bear where there might be the occasional jump. But most of the time, it's just staying within, like we were within this 20 to 30K range for what felt like a year. And so there I'm like, okay, they'll be checking it the whole time and they'll be like, oh, it's gone down a little bit. It's gone up a little bit. Like the guy that accepts Bitcoin for bodyboarding gear, body surfing, bodyboarding stuff. I onboarded him like 2 years ago. And for the first 6 months, I every time I walked past his house, he was like, oh, Bitcoin. And I was like, dude, like, and he's there and he had like, I don't know, maybe 250 euros of Bitcoin because I bought some flippers and some bodyboard stuff. Basically, I'd hurt my leg, so I couldn't surf. So I was just like bodyboarding and trying it out. And I didn't like it as much as surfing, but whatever, it was a thing. But that 250 euros that I bought that stuff with is now worth, you know, maybe near a grand. So he's like fully... He fully gets it, you know, and he's that was really actually that he accepted it through. It was on chain. So, you know, it would have been awesome if it was with Lightning back then. But either way, he gets it because he's seen that run up to the bull market. But now the question is he going to go like all in and be like, well, shit, it's 3x'd in, a year. Am I going to have to now like really commit? So it's always tricky. You just don't want anyone to get wrecked on your watch. You know, it's always a concern.
Yeah, that's true. So is this basically your full-time job? You just travel the world and orange pill people?
That would be a great full-time job. So the Joe Nakamoto business is effectively journalism and content creation in Bitcoin, because in my opinion, Bitcoin does not have good journalists and it does not have good journalism, sparing a few like really well-known characters in the space who, to be honest, most of the time they do books and articles. But when it comes to video journalism, we tend to do like cheering on sort of like shareable content or like memes. But there's no one that actually goes to these places where there is like serious or meaningful levels of adoption and tries to tell the story of what's going on there. We'll get the mainstream view, i.e. the Guardian reporter that goes to El Zonte, Bitcoin Beach, goes to McDonald's in El Salvador, buys a burger and says, no one's using Bitcoin, and they go home. You know, there's lots of documentaries of that type, but there are very few content creators, YouTubers that are actually trying to document, examine and investigate this Bitcoin thing and the Bitcoin adoption and Bitcoin community stories in real time. And with like, okay, we could be pro Bitcoin with our bias, because that's the point of the name Joe Nakamoto is to indicate that, of course, I have a bias towards Bitcoin. But, you know, the Guardian, the Financial Times, the Times, the Telegraph, they all have a bias against Bitcoin. So I think it's fair to point that out. But yeah, the idea was to tell these stories around the world. So for example, right now I'm working on a story from a place called Bitcoin Witzend in South Africa, which is, I think, the highest per capita percentage of Bitcoiners anywhere in the world. Like at least 40% of the town is holding their own keys. It's a small town of like 500 people. So it's also a tiny, tiny, tiny town. But the way that one of the organizers of the town describes it, he says, I hope that Bitcoin Witzend can be a place where people can point to it and say, look, they were successful with this circular economy idea. So maybe we can try it too. And I'm also working on something from Bitcoin Akasi, which I'm sure you know. And separately, I did a tour of Turkey with a really well-known crypto influencer. And so that one was more about why crypto is thriving in a country where there's hyperinflation and you know, people need a way out. And it was basically saying that, okay, Bitcoin needs to do better at marketing, because in Turkey, crypto influencers, trading, leverage, all those sorts of things work really, really well. And it's because most people needed a 5X yesterday. You know, you try to talk to them about, oh, if you save a little bit in Bitcoin every day, then in 10 years time, you'll be rich. They're like, I don't care. My money is being debased at a horrific, horrific level. So I'm trying to bring these stories together. And originally I was working on value for value for monetization, but it doesn't work. So now I'm going down the sponsors route, as is, you know, typical for a lot of these media agencies and, you know, content creators generally. Stuff to be announced soon. I mean,
you have advisory positions, obviously, at Relay, but also others like Orange Pill App, I think.
Yeah.
Of other companies that you work with?
Yeah, they're unpaid though. So Heatbit is the other one. They're a great company. I don't have it right now, but they're currently on in my new office. So Heatbit's just like a Bitcoin miner in a sort of Dyson style tube thing. You plug it into the wall, connect it to the Wi-Fi on your app, and then you start mining Bitcoin. But you're not like just mining Bitcoin. You're basically creating heat. So it's basically a heater that also mines Bitcoin. But don't buy it if you're wanting to mine Bitcoin and get rich. That's not the point. The idea is to just have a heater which heats and which looks quite nice, but also you just happen to be mining some Bitcoin. So like you can get, on good days, you'll get $1 a day. So it's not, you know, you're not going to quit your job anytime soon with it. And I forget, I'm an advisor to Free Madeira as well, but that's really just a, what's the word? I don't know. I've done nothing for them. I went to the conference. I try to help out where I can. I'm in the group. I try to be useful, but I'm not doing what I'm doing for the other companies I work for. But yeah, unfortunately, that's not enough.
You're also at every conference, right? So you're a moderator, basically moderator.
Yes.
Almost like every conference. You moderated this panel that we were on with Jack Mallers and Giacomo Succo and Max. This was awesome. This is really fun.
It was a lot of fun.
You should do that more.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm trying to make a monetization path as well, and especially the MC work. So like previously people would be like, oh, we're doing a conference, do you want to come on as the MC and do it? And I'm like, I don't think people realize that if you have a good MC or if you have a good moderator, it completely elevates the entire experience for not just the audience, but like the overall experience of the conference. And so I realized, okay, this is a gap that I can fill. I love being on stage. I like to like entertain people generally. And I think I have that sort of extra factor that people like to see. Like I'm happy to embarrass myself in public. I'm happy to, you know, make jokes at my expense, at the audience expense, and also to try and be educational and entertaining at the same time. And so I got the first opportunity to do this in Edinburgh in 2020 or 2021 at the UK Bitcoin conference. And I'd done this previously for Bloomberg Professional Services and Oxford Business Group in Africa at like some conferences. But bear in mind that these were very formal. You know, I was wearing a suit. I had short hair. I was, you know, Joe Hall, very, you know, yeah. That was sort of my transition. Yeah. You had to
imagine that. Maybe our team can basically put you into a tower, into like an office, window front office with suit and tie. That would be fun.
For the meme, do it. But because I had that professional experience and I was like, okay, this is how super formal conferences go. I was like, Bitcoin conferences, they are to an extent a conference with formal side to it. But if you look at the Funchal one, it was in a football stadium, for God's sake. Like a football stadium is an arena. It is where people go to get entertained. So you could tell straight away that the vibe there is, let's get people on their feet. Let's get people clapping. Let's get people cheering. Let's get people laughing. Yeah. And so, it went from there. And I have now got...
drinking beer.
Yeah, exactly, right? That doesn't happen at a Bloomberg conference. I can tell you that for free. But I've managed to somehow monetize that aspect as well. So now I can say like, okay, I'm a professional MC because... you're a professional once you've been paid for it.
What is it that you have you studied journalism, or like is this how you started your career, or did you grow into it through Bitcoin?
So I studied languages and economics at Edinburgh University and did a master's there, and then obviously had to unlearn all of that, what with the Bitcoin stuff coming through. But no, I was living in London and I'd done 2 years living there, and I was in a lot of debt. And I was like, why do I not have any money at the end of the month? What is going on here? And I thought I had like a decent enough salary, but money just kept disappearing. And then I saw a job advert which said, travel 11 months of the year, get paid to interview business leaders. And I was like, this sounds like a wonderful scam. Sign me up. And so I flew to Madrid for a job interview. And the job interview process was kind of like The Apprentice, or do they call it Shark Tank in the US? Oh, no, the thing that Donald Trump used to host. I think it's still The Apprentice.
And fired.
That's it. Yeah. So every 4 hours, we do like group activities and challenges and like team building stuff. And then the CEO and the COO would bring us into a room, fire us with questions, and then some of us would go home. And we were like 16 people. And at the end of the second day in the evening, there was two of us. And then the last round was like, sell me your competitor, like sell me the other person wants the job, which is like, you could see that coming, but it was kind of funny. And fortunately, we both got the job. And then I went to Serbia the next day to start working for them. And it was kind of like, yeah. And it was like, quit your job and just do this. And it's funny though, like when you hear like Mr. Beast podcasts and the approach of a lot of like hardcore entrepreneurs in the US, they'll have that mindset as well, which is like either you're in or you're out. And if you're in, then you start tomorrow and that's it. Otherwise the job, it just isn't there for you. And also, you know, they're testing you.
Strange, like recruiting, the recruiting process is basically one day. So I get to know you as a recruiter, I get to know you in the morning, in the evening I decide, and from tomorrow I work with you. So there's not even a night in between where I can like think about it.
Well, yeah, it was 2 days in total, but still it's far too short. But the idea is to create a high stress environment in which you can understand how their personality shines through and how they react to these sort of difficult environments. And also because my job was to interview business leaders, CEOs and key opinion leaders and even politicians, you're always going to be in quite challenging environments, in environments where there's a lot of power. And that could be used against you in order to lie to you or to twist the truth or whatever it is. So our job was, I was the journalist and then always went with two other people. One was like the salesperson. And then there was also like the assistant. And my job was to interview influential and powerful people and then write reports about it.
What were the highlights that you interviewed, like the other people?
It's funny that the Portugal stuff is funny because I interviewed the Minister of Health, the Minister of Finance, the Minister of Defense in 2018. In the Ivory Coast, I interviewed the Minister of Defense. That was terrifying because like when we go to these countries, we were going there. It was like having a startup. You get dropped into a country and then the idea would be, okay, in 6 months' time, we need to put together a financial report which investors will like and which they'll be able to act off. But in that financial report, the way that we get paid is that we get advertising segments which are bought by some of the companies that we work with. So in a way, it wasn't really journalism. It was like sponsored content journalism because at the end of every interview, there'd be a pitch for a advert. I didn't like the ethics of this company and this style of work. It's actually got a name. It's called The Industry, and it still goes on to this day. And there are lots of young, ambitious 20-somethings that end up doing this kind of work. But yeah, the Ivory Coast one was a funny one because when you go to these countries, you want to interview the public sector first and get photos with, say, the head of finance or the head of healthcare or whatever it is, that you can then pitch the pharmaceutical industry with a picture of you and say, Julian, you are the Minister of Finance. I want a picture of you to then go to the banks and say, okay, I've got a picture with the Minister of Finance called Julian. You should probably accept an interview with me because I'm, you know, I'm worth my shit. Yeah. And yeah, to get the Minister of Defense, I was at a bar in Abidjan on like the fourth or fifth night. And I was with some French girls, some of whom were quite pretty. And this big black dude, like leaning on his chair, being like the king of the castle sort of thing, just like points at me. And he's like, you come over. And I was like, oh. And he had like his security guards around him. And he's like, I like the people you're with. You know, will you sit with me? And I was like, yeah, sure. Whatever you want, mate. And we start chatting and the girls start. Yeah, and we start chatting. And I was like, by the way, mate, I'm here as a journalist. Would you be open to an interview next week? And he was like, yeah, whatever you want, mate. Have a drink. You know, come sit with me. And I was like, this is really interesting, old fashioned business. Yeah. And I was just looking at security and the guns.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God.
Okay. That horrifies. But I think the best deals actually still get closed over some gin tonics. It's a good bonding experience. That's also why conferences are important. Get drunk together and party together is fun, but also bonding, right?
Oh, big time. Yeah. I think most good deals get done like that. You know, we were talking about how we're both listening to the Elon Musk or reading the Elon Musk biopic or biography while in Madeira. And even that, you realize how much goes on like behind the scenes. And, you know, I experienced that with my own work, that in order to really get to know someone, you've also got to sort of have a sort of familiarity or a bond with them. And having seen how business gets done in Africa and seen how it gets done in the West as well, it's still like, obviously there are certain places which are completely old fashioned, and it's like, you've got to be someone's cousin's cousin, or, you know, you got to, your wife has got to be in with the, whichever business. Yeah. Well, yeah. But then you look at the Prime Minister of the UK right now, and Rishi Sunak, you know, he's married to a billionaire steel and metal magnate. And, you know, how many doors has that opened for him? So it's it may have a different sheen to it in the West, but it's still critically the same formula of, you know, who you know, what influence do you have over them, what leverage do you have with them, and then how can you use that to advance your position? It's exactly.
That's something that's never will never change, how like power evolves and is distributed, etc., with these very tight knit, almost family like networks that you spin and develop, etc. It's just in our human nature, right? It's and technology and whatever other advancements we make, it doesn't really change who we are as human beings. That's how we operate, right?
Yeah, it's that implicit trust, and then within that, like the power, the influence, the leverage. It was certainly an eye-opening experience. And as a 20-something-year-old who hadn't grown, like my parents were both doctors, so I was never really exposed to private business and entrepreneurship and all that sort of thing. For me, it was completely eye-opening because, you know, I did business in Trinidad and Tobago, I did it in Tunisia, I did it in the Ivory Coast, Portugal, Serbia, I can't remember the other countries I went to. And all of them, you start realizing that, okay, humans are absolutely identical wherever you go in the world. They're just operating within different rule structures. Yeah. And I say rule structures because, of course, say Cuba, you've got incredibly strict rules, but no one's really following them because there's a black market that does the job way better. Because, you know, the free market always finds a way to resolve, you know, most problems like within reason, right? Totally. And so, yeah, it was a good experience.
How did you get into Cointelegraph, which was your last big gig before you then turned into self-employment, right? And you were there for like, what, 3 years probably?
Yeah, 2.5 years in total. Like with numbers, I think technically, on my LinkedIn, it'll say 3, of course. Always got to round up. I was fed up with Oxford Business Group, which is the last sort of mainstream employer that I had. And the experience during the pandemic and the way in which they treated us wasn't amazing. And on top of that, I was getting increasingly fervent with my conviction of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And I tried to write Bitcoin pieces, whether it was about remittance into sub-Saharan Africa, or it was just about the fact that, you know, Bitcoin use and adoption was on the rise in the countries we visited, despite the fact that in Morocco, for example, where I did a 2-week project, Bitcoin is illegal and yet Moroccans are using it. So it's a... Yeah. There was a guy arrested last year for buying a Ferrari with Bitcoin in Morocco. They were obviously making an example of him.
No, it's illegal in Morocco.
Yeah, and Algeria and Bolivia. There's still quite a few countries around the world where Bitcoin is full-on illegal. And it's also, as you'd expect, the places that I want to go to investigate these Bitcoin communities that are there. Like, I have an editor who does like occasional work for me who lives in Algeria. And I've been trying to talk to him about telling his story of how he uses Bitcoin and the way he uses it with his community. But he's obviously, and rightly so, he is worried about his identity and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But I'm used to that now, because with the Cuba documentary, we had to be very careful about revealing people's identities, because Cuba is obviously a communist and authoritarian state, and you don't want people to be hurt for, you know, work you've done and the truth you're trying to share. So yeah, I mean, where were we? We were talking about, I've lost my train of thought, man. Mate, what we're talking
time?
About?
Did you have a good time at Cointelegraph? Like, you were...
Oh, that was it, yeah.
You were also doing a lot of crypto shit, probably. I don't know. I didn't follow that too much. You did a lot of Bitcoin-only content. You were always at these Bitcoin-only conferences, etc. But Cointelegraph, as of itself, is one of the biggest, probably in the industry, right? One of the biggest media outlets, but also a lot of just Web3 and crypto, which is fine. I mean, it's good
mostly
to cover all these things. But were you mostly focusing on Bitcoin? Did you have a good time there?
Yeah, so I tried to cover Bitcoin as much as I could. But then sometimes you'd get instructions to cover Web3 and crypto stuff. And I was just like, I would always try to find some excuse or some reason not to do it, or I would always make myself so busy with the Bitcoin content that there would be, I wouldn't be available to take that. And I was like quite proud that if you look at all of my content on Cointelegraph, whenever I've written about crypto, it's through the eyes of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So like, there's even a piece about how like blockchain conferences don't know about Bitcoin. So like, obviously there it's the fact that I went to a blockchain conference, but you know, I was interviewing people and they just didn't know what Bitcoin was. They'd never used it. They'd never used the Lightning Network. And yet they're at a blockchain conference. So I think it was to try to sort of really explain that there's a massive divide between what we think people perceive to or to understand as Bitcoin and this crypto Web3 nonsense industry, which is doing a completely different thing. And it's almost weird to put the two against each other because they are just so, so, so very different. You know, it's like comparing AI and, you know, the longevity space or something. Yeah, there are some similarities between the way in which they approach problems, but ultimately they're trying to achieve different goals. And yeah, the crypto and Web3 stuff wore me out at Cointelegraph, and it was probably that and a few other things were one of the reasons I wanted to leave. I did just want to stand on my own 2 feet and try out my own sort of business idea. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the Cointelegraph ETF tweet was just so stupid. They've employed some dodgy characters, and they've just got some interesting ethics about certain things that obviously I won't talk about publicly, but by the end of last year, I was just getting more and more stressed about how Cointelegraph presents itself publicly and how that would reflect on me. Mm. And within the Bitcoin space, you know, people were starting to know me more as Joe Nakamoto than they were as Joe Nakamoto, this reporter at Cointelegraph.
Definitely.
And I wanted to distance it.
Your personal brand has grown massively, right? And you're standing in the Bitcoin community really as Joe Nakamoto, not as just Cointelegraph, whatever. But what led you to do your own thing instead of just moving to maybe a Bitcoin-only outlet like Bitcoin Magazine, for example?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think they did want me, and I don't think they'll mind me saying that as well. But part of it was just, you know, I turned 30 last year and I was like, I want to do my own thing. I want to try something out. The other thing was I'd been fed up of working for other people for so long. And then like the Cuba documentary, for example, the Cuba Cointelegraph documentary, it belongs to Cointelegraph. And it's my like best work, in my opinion. You know, I'm basically banned from Cuba. It's got all the ingredients of this most amazing story. And Bitcoin is the only tool that fixes the situation and the problems they face there. And yet it lives on Cointelegraph. And I'm so annoyed because I'm like, I want that to live as my content that I made. So part of it was like, I want there to be a space where all of this stuff, you know, belongs to me, as opposed to belonging to this organization, which doesn't actually align with my ethics and my values and my conviction in Bitcoin. Like most people that work at Cointelegraph are not Bitcoiners, and they won't be anytime soon. And I'm, you know, and it's not on me to change that either. You know, I'm not going to be this Trojan horse within this system. Like I thought at the start, very arrogantly almost and naively, that I could make Cointelegraph from shit Cointelegraph into Bitcoin Telegraph. And if you look at all my content, you know, I'm trying to do that. And if you look at all the YouTube documentaries, since I became like a video journalist at Cointelegraph, all of the documentaries on Cointelegraph are Bitcoin focused. They're all about Bitcoin stories around the world. So I'm really proud of like the work and the influence I've done there. But after, you know, 2.5, pushing 3 years of it, I was partially fed up. And then on top of that, I made a deal with this guy called Jikeme in Peru, who was really instrumental and really helpful with the Peru work, which I'm still working on the documentaries for, which is basically a load of Bitcoin circular economies in 11 places in Peru. And basically we had like this quite drunken night out in Lima in Peru. And I was just like unwinding all this nonsense that I was going through and just all the random crap that just comes with working in the crypto space generally. And he was like, oh, so at what Bitcoin price would you quit Cointelegraph? And I was like, huh, good question. Because, you know, there is that price that we all think, oh, you know, okay, maybe it is possible. Maybe I can stand on my own 2 feet then. And the price must have been 23K or something. So I was like, okay, sod it. 42K, I'll quit Cointelegraph. And so the moment it hit 42K, he was texting me, being like, so are you quitting? And I was like, I forwarded him the message of my resignation letter and was just like, yeah, so.
You agreed to it.
Yeah. Yeah. But the resignation was a soft resignation. Like I still can write content on Cointelegraph. Cointelegraph still has one documentary of mine, which they still haven't published, which is so frustrating. It's actually from Switzerland, from Lugano, the Bitcoin school. Like I attended there as a journalist and tried to tell the story of it. And we are now 9 months since I went to the country. So this is the other thing, like Cointelegraph is a business. It's not a journalism outlet. Yeah. So if they have someone that pays to get a video, which most videos are, then they take priority over me doing a journalism style documentary or story. And that was another reason I did a pros and cons list, and the pros for leaving were like completely outweighed the cons of leaving.
There are a couple of very convincing points. Like one, you really get the equity of your content. You have that. And if something goes viral or you can monetize it extremely well, or like it's an evergreen thing that will live on for 10, 20, 30 years, whatever, will be seen in the internet and viewed and clicked, etc. And so you get the whole thing, right? So if you do that for a couple of years, you have this whole basket full of videos that are being clicked, that are being monetized, and you are getting this as a person and not a company is profiting from it. And then also you're independent, you can control, you can decide which ones to publish when and which ones not, which ones to take off maybe, etc., you know. So you're really in control, and so I mean, for you especially with your personality, I mean, it's this was a no-brainer, right, to do it. It's
I wish it was I wish I had that confidence and that self-assurance, but it was a process. And you know, I'm actually really, I mean, I think you'll probably, this will probably resonate with you, but you know, when you started Relay, your life completely changes and you're faced with totally different problems and, you know, different ways of problem solving than you did previously. And now I've hired a few people to work with me, and I'm working out how to, you know, those key questions you bring up, like how to monetize and, you know, what direction it's going to go in and how to work out the voice that I'm trying to put across. And you know, fortunately, I think I have worked out how to monetize this year, which for a first year of a startup is, you know, job done. Well, second and third year, who knows, we'll go down the line. But the timing is also crucial, because if we are entering a bull run, which I think we can safely say we are, then like the stories that I'm making now will hopefully reach more and more people and will help them understand the reality of Bitcoin on the ground, as opposed to it being purely this speculative asset for the wealthy. And, you know, like, of course, like we all need to stack, we all need to hodl. You know, that's why I'm delighted to support the likes of Relay. But at the same time, there are people using Bitcoin in weird and wonderful ways on the ground in countries that don't have the freedoms that we have in Switzerland or Portugal. And telling their stories is not only meaningful to me, but hopefully it conveys these messages that will allow people around the world to be like, huh, that's so cool that this thing that is my savings tool is literally undermining authoritarian regimes in Cuba or Iran or South Africa. Like how cool is that? And like, what a wonderful thing to get behind and be like, actually, you know, it's like the Bitcoin mining stuff, right? Like it's been demonized for so long. And then you hear these stories of like farmers in Ireland that are using it to, like, with renewable energy alone, they're able to save their businesses. And so these are the kind of like underdog stories that I'm trying to tell that will hopefully correct this narrative that we see from the mainstream about Bitcoin, and also help Bitcoiners around the world have more conviction about this, you know, savings tool.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And really also some initiatives that maybe you can now, as a self-employed guy, you can focus more on. Like, for example, we talked before starting to record about this emoji thing, right? I just one quick video. So there's some. Can you tell me and the audience what it is about this Bitcoin emoji thing that you and others are now working with? Where did this come from?
It's actually an initiative that started via like a conglomerate of companies, but they want to keep it sort of not faceless, but they want to keep it without a sponsor. They don't want to say like, oh, it was all thanks to Coinbase that we had this emoji in the App Store. But basically, Taco Bell managed to get an emoji into the emoji library after 50,000 signatures. Seriously. That's why there's a taco emoji.
For example, in WhatsApp or Telegram, that's where I can find a Taco Bell emoji now.
Well, just the taco emoji is thanks to Taco Bell, because they lobbied their customers and collected signatures, and with 50,000 emojis, they got them through. Tinder did the same thing with the interracial emoji. So there's now like a black and an Asian, or a white and a, I don't know, Hispanic, or like different colored like emojis. I use the word colored there in terms of literal colors, not, you know, using derogatory language. I've got to be really careful with this, you know. God damn it. Also,
What?
And I've just come back from South Africa as well, where like the word "coloured" is literally a word in of itself. So it's like, how do you say these things? And anyway, there's an interracial emoji with Tinder. Help me dig myself out of this hole. And it's because they also lobbied Unicode Labs, so the guys that put these emoji libraries together, with a load of signatures. And so my job, or these guys pitched me and said, "Can you help us make content?" And they were like, "I like that." The reason why they pitched me was, you don't have any ties to a single company, and you are like, the Joe Nakamoto brand is like Bitcoin activism, Bitcoin evangelism, and Bitcoin journalism. So like, and obviously you make content in the Bitcoin space. And I was like, this is a cool challenge, hence why I've got this green screen behind me. But the idea is, over a series of videos and some collaborations with other sort of big name Bitcoin influencers and podcasters and creators, try to get enough signatures that are, to be meaningful, so that Unicode Labs takes it seriously and considers adding the Bitcoin emoji to our libraries, so that when we go on WhatsApp or Telegram or whatever, we'll be able to not only, you know, use the Bitcoin emoji, but also react with the Bitcoin emoji to certain things, because we are a 10 to 100 million strong community of Bitcoiners around the world, and we're all communicating about Bitcoin the whole time.
It's long overdue, actually. I just never thought about it, and it's super interesting to hear what this process is. So basically, for almost anything, you could get an emoji done in this Unicode that is usable everywhere.
Well,
1,000 signatures should be.
Well, this is the logic, right? This is the logic, that because there's been this precedent set by these two other companies that with 50,000 you can get it into the Emoji Labs library. However, on their website, they did put a statement out maybe 6 months ago saying, it's not our job to decide what is a religion or a currency, because they had some other people trying to get other random emojis into the Unicode library. So it's not going to be the smoothest ride. And that's why I'm also trying to make a documentary about this story, like how we got the Bitcoin emoji into the Unicode library, or how we didn't. And so as part of that story, I want to fly out to their headquarters, get a meeting with them, and basically say, can I try to get the Joe Nakamoto emoji into the library? And they'll be like, no, you're an idiot. But the whole point is to demonstrate that, like, it isn't easy. It isn't straightforward. You can't just get a load of signatures and get it into the library. They've also got to agree to it. But it's just also really funny because it's this completely centralized structure, which is used in a decentralized fashion by billions of people on a daily basis. Like WhatsApp has 1 billion or 2 billion users, and they're all using these emojis every day. And yet there isn't a Bitcoin one yet. And does a Bitcoin one open the floodgates to an Ethereum one? Who knows?
The Ethereum community can work on that. We will work on ours. But we need that. I mean, how can after 15 years and so many people using it, how can it not be? Like, it is at this point one of the most well-known brands. It's probably one of the most keywords on all the social media platforms. It's talked about so loud. There's huge traffic and volume around Bitcoin. It's basically, it's inherent into our global culture at this point. Why is it not an emoji? I really don't.
This is what my second video is going to be about. Like, in the first one, I bring up the fact that, you know, Tinder and Taco Bell did it. In the second one, it's going to be like, why isn't it a thing? Like, Bitcoin is literally everywhere. And, you know, we've got countries using it as a money. So clearly it is a currency. And I think it is probably the most recognizable brand. It's like the Jolly Roger, you know, the pirate ship flag. Mm-hmm. Like, that was historically the world's most recognizable brand. And the whole point of that brand, like, there's a really good book about this. It's called Be More Pirate. It's like kind of a business book / life coaching book. I don't know how to describe it, like a bit of a self-help book. But it talks about, you know, famous examples of what pirates have done in the past. Like, pirates were the first people to bring about healthcare, but like in a sort of national health service fashion, because you would have health insurance. If you like lost an eye, it was like 5 gold coins. And if you lost a leg, it was like 20 gold coins. And everyone on the ship would contribute so that if someone did lose an eye or a leg, there would be this pot to pay them out from. And obviously this was way before, this is 1600s. This is way before healthcare became a thing in the West, which is like late 1800s, early 1900s. Mm. And then one of the other examples was the Jolly Roger, which was supposed to be a recognizable brand, which would project power. This is obviously very different to the Bitcoin B, which isn't projecting power. It's just literally saying, like, you know, pro Bitcoin. But that Jolly Roger, it could sail, you know, around a port, or it could sail, you know, near to the coastline. And people would be like, it's pirates, and yet the whole point was that they didn't, pirates weren't actually that bloodthirsty. If you look at like the amount of sort of battles and things they did, the whole point was to project this idea of violence, but actually be really good at negotiating. And so, yeah, I don't know why I went off that rant, but basically the Bitcoin B is as unrecognizable as the Jolly Roger, the skull and crossbones pirate flag.
It is. And it is at this point one of the biggest assets in the world. It has surpassed silver. It has surpassed the Swiss franc, for example, as a currency. So it's in top 10 of the biggest currencies and all the currencies you can find in as an emoji. No?
Kind of. Yeah. You can. There's the yen, there's the dollar, and there's the euro. Don't know if it's a pound, but the pound is way smaller now anyway. So,
Well, okay, maybe. I mean, it's one of the main currencies. It's one of the main assets. You can find silver and gold as an emoji. So why not the
Wait, can you? Yeah, I need to check these things because these are good ways of starting it.
Let's start sending each other on Signal.
This is great content, Julian. your listeners are going to love this.
Yeah, that's the problem. Okay, gold is not an emoji.
Well, there you go. This is our next campaign. We'll get all the gold bugs together. And
not an emoji. The gold bugs haven't even achieved this.
Well, it's because they're all like 70 plus years old, aren't they? It's very seldom I hear anyone, our age.
Peter Schiff.
Yeah, that's true.
Peter Schiff, come on, you need to lead that movement.
Well, he's got his own emoji anyway. He's got the grey-haired dude as the emoji. I mean, gold, you could argue gold has an emoji because it has the medal, like the Olympic medal that's gold.
Yeah. Okay.
So I guess that's how they communicate, where they're like, oh, gold conference coming up soon, Olympic medal.
Euro has one. It's literally a Euro banknote. USD, dollar. Yeah, dollar, of course, yeah.
Yeah, it's got several.
Three, yeah, even several.
Yeah.
Okay, we need that.
He's even got the face, yeah. Yeah, this is the plan. So please retweet and share and get it in front of them. And I want to make it into a documentary as well and tell the story of how we did it. Because I think that, again, this is the sort of thing that we'll look back in 10 or 20 years' time and be like, whoa, that was, another milestone. It's not like huge, but it's significant. You know, this is a keyboard library that's used by billions of people every day. And why not have the Bitcoin one?
Legitimacy this gives to Bitcoin.
There you go. And that's what it needs.
Last question for you.
Okay.
So out of your total wealth, what percentage do you hold in Bitcoin? Because I feel like you are one of the most committed guy. It's Bitcoin. You're trying to live on Bitcoin standard. As you ask,
for 3 years.
Can I buy this ice cream with Bitcoin? Do you accept Bitcoin? Even the taxi driver, you were late like 15 minutes to the Madeira because you were arguing with the taxi driver because you wanted to buy and pay him Bitcoin. So what?
That was a low moment. I just didn't have cash, and I was like, shit, I literally don't have cash to pay this guy, so I have to pay him in Bitcoin. And I paid him double in Bitcoin to explain to it. By the way, his Bitcoin's now gone up like 1.4x. So he should be grateful. Yeah. So my total wealth, I think it's probably about like 180% in Bitcoin, I'd say. Because
that's the highest one I've ever heard I ask this question.
Is actually?
This is the highest one, of course.
Oh no, that's not good. This is not the sort of thing you want to win at. Because my, like, all my wealth has always, wealth is a big word, all my money has always been in Bitcoin, since I went all in. And the whole point of going all in was to see if it would make sense to do so. Like, I wanted to properly don't trust verify with journalism, how this Bitcoin thing worked. And so, I think it was early 2021, I got rid of like my last sort of fiat beans or fiat tokens. And since then, any tax issues or whatever, I've had to sell some Bitcoin to pay them. But what I say 180%, because my business is now all Bitcoin. It's also the business only accepts, I'm trying to make it only accept Bitcoin, and the fiat money that I received, one of them, which is Relay, that one just goes straight to my, don't worry, man, I actually need it. That's the issue. So like this new office space that I've taken on, it is, they're accepting half Bitcoin, half fiat to try it out. This is how I try to sort of onboard some people. And yeah, so those fiat payments go straight to the fiat debts that I have. And yeah, I'd say that 80% is because the employees that I have, I pay them in Bitcoin. Half my rent, half my office rent is paid in Bitcoin. And everything that I own is Bitcoin. And obviously all my clothes are Bitcoin related. I've got Bitcoin themed everything. So it's also just the assets that I do have, which are very few, are Bitcoin related in some shape or form. The Joe Nakamoto brand is, of course, a Bitcoin brand. So if Bitcoin was to break, then that entire brand would break as well. And all of the speaking opportunities, events, contracts, everything I have is related to Bitcoin and only Bitcoin. So I'd say 108%. Because if Bitcoin were to fall, I would be less 108% easy.
You're pretty much as all in as it gets, and you will go under with Bitcoin.
Oh, big time. I'll be drowning, at the bottom of the Titanic if this ship really does crash.
Either you make it like big time, or you will have learned a lot from it and also profited from it. So this is the way. You need to go all in, because then you win big time or you lose, but then you have won also, because everything you've learned, all the network you've made over the years, etc., all the experience, all your personal brand, even with another industry, you will be able to use that big time. So congrats.
I hope so.
It's great
thank
great
you.
Work you're doing. Really happy to have you on the advisory board of Relay, and see you soon, probably at the next conference in Prague, I guess.
Yes, I will be emceeing. See you on stage, everyone. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on, Julian. It was lovely to chat and hang out. And it's equally my privilege and my delight to be an advisor to Relay as well. So it's very cool seeing that slowly become Europe's first unicorn, Bitcoin unicorn.
Boom. Love it. Cheers, buddy. Have a good one.
Cheers, mate. Ciao, ciao.